Sydney Planning Changes Part 2. In the last episode, I called it the trifecta of wow, the greatest opportunity, one of the greatest opportunities for Sydney real estate in a very, very long time, a huge potential alpha return available associated with some of the biggest planning changes this city has ever seen. That's what the New South Wales state government is proposing, and we're going to go through it. Sounds like hyperbole. It sounds crazy when I say it out loud. But when you go through the detail, like we did in the last episode, you can understand that what the New South Wales government is proposing is a complete change to many, many pockets of Sydney and a statewide overhaul, really, of our planning system that allows more density and more housing to help solve the housing affordability crisis that we face at the moment. In this episode, we're going to go through why they're doing this, what it means for property investors and homeowners all across the city. And we're going to answer a few questions to help investors who are looking at this opportunity as a potential area for them to look at and help frame what they should be looking out for and some of the discussion points associated with this change. Curtis, let's get into it.
Yeah, the trifecta of wow. I guess we're definitely not running a poetry podcast, that's for sure. So last episode, we kind of unpacked what the changes were and went through those in a little bit of detail. So yeah, this episode, we really want to unpack what that can mean as an investor, what the strategy options are, the pros and cons of pursuing this as an investment opportunity in Sydney. So yeah, let's dive into it. In terms of, I guess, for starters, for investors, how are you going to benefit from these changes?
Yeah. Well, if you own land that benefits from this change, like that changes what you can do on that, then particularly if it's an old house and it's not like an owner-occupier type product, in the sense that it could be an investor that purchases it or someone who wants to develop it, what they can do with that land changes, could change. And if that changes, then the value of your land may change too. Now, I've done the analysis a little bit as to which areas benefit the most. But broadly speaking, one of the reasons why this is so important to solve housing supply issues is over time, when build costs rise so much, and now it costs, you know, $400,000 plus to build one single apartment, and, you know, $500,000 to build a house or any form of detached housing product. That's the sort of starting point prices at the moment. Now, when prices of build costs get so high, the only way to make feasibilities positive is by allowing more density, more height, and more sort of dwellings on the same plot of land. And when you do so, then the feasibility looks positive again for that developer, and they're going to realize that development. I mean, they're not going to just leave the land the way it is. They're going to complete it because now they have a monetary incentive to go and do it. Much better to turn an old house, for example, into a six-level apartment if you can, and that level of change makes it possible. While if you made it a duplex site, that person might look at it and be like, nah, I'd rather just keep it as is. It's not much of a benefit. I'll just keep holding it or I'll keep living in it. Meanwhile, when you have this level of uplift and you increase the density component, the economics of that is it translates into results, into actual new housing. So that is the big reason why they're doing it. And for property investors, if you own a piece of land here, depending on which area your land is, every individual dwelling will benefit differently, but it'll all be based around what you can do with that land pre and post these zoning changes. So yeah, maybe we'll go through a couple examples of that, for example.
Yeah. And like you say, you know, the objective is really to boost housing supply. And, you know, there's a lot of commentary on that at the moment, but essentially it has to be financially attractive for, you know, people to do so if you actually want, you know, the spades in the ground and the construction to get completed. So like you say, these changes allowing an increased number of dwellings is what's changing the feasibilities and the calculations for developers to be like, look, like you say, previously it might have been a site where it's like, ah, there's not really that much in it for me to undertake this project. There's not that much value in it. Yep. Like, so why would I do it? Into something that pushes you clearly into the positive and is either incentivizing whoever owns the land now to do it or to sell it off to someone that's going to do it. And get that kind of process moving.
Yep, that's true. The best use of land, though, often changes not only on zoning, but based on the value amounts of the land itself versus the cost of construction. So that bit's key. Just because you're allowed to build a tower on your land doesn't mean your land is actually worth more. I said it pretty simply before, it costs $400,000 to build an apartment. That price is roughly the price for a base level apartment, whether it's in Campbelltown or whether it's in Rose Bay. Typically, if you're going to be building in Rose Bay, you're going to be paying, you're going to be building a nice apartment because that's the clientele who's going to be buying it. And it might cost you $500,000, $600,000, $700,000, $800,000. It might cost you a lot more, but you're going to be building a much nicer dwelling. But the base cost of like basic level apartment isn't that different between those two locations. Now, if you are going to sell your apartment for $400,000 at the end of it, then the value of that land is going to be owner-occupier pill only. It's not going to change because of high density, because no one is going to go and complete that. Meanwhile, if there's a big spread in that cost, for example, it's in more premium areas where apartments cost $1 million, for example, then the more apartments you can get onto that dwelling, then the greater the value of that land is going to be. So that probably tells you a little bit about why Sydney is kind of the big alpha beneficiary of property zoning type changes, because there's higher apartment value prices and higher detached dwelling or townhouse type value prices here than in other capitals, where the spread between the land cost and the construction cost is greater, and that creates opportunities for investors.
Yeah, so let's unpack some of the pros and cons in a little bit more detail. Why don't we do the cons first? Because everyone normally does the exciting stuff first. So let's do the negatives first, or the risks pursuing, you know, a site like this as an investment strategy. Obviously, you know, there's big opportunity for alpha gains. We're not discounting that. But it's not a risk-free strategy or a cost-free strategy that you just kind of purchase it and you magically make some huge return. So yeah, do you want to unpack some of the risks when you go down this path?
Yeah, there's a lot of risks, definitely. First one is, what if none of these changes actually happen? The state government has repeatedly said, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. Local governments say this and that. The actual realization of what is said and what is done in planning is very, very different to other forms of policies. You know, at a federal level, when the government says we're going to do this tax, they usually do it, or they get close to doing it. On a state-by-state sort of planning level, often zoning-type changes get heaps of pushback, the not-in-my-backyard theory, and that creates a backdown. I would be very surprised if there's not some level of backdown from the state government here. They've come out with a bazooka to policy changing here. It's so big that there's going to be pushback, and that pushback can mean that there's a backdown from the state government here at some point. Where that backdown is, don't know. So you might be buying a piece of land being like, hey, I'm going to buy this and it's going to benefit. But then the state government's back down on that component of their plan change and be like, oh, actually, no, we're not going to include this. That happens. That is obviously a very big risk. The second big risk is, in Sydney, there's a negative cash flow from buying investments. And these are development sites. These have huge negative cash flows. You're going to struggle to get a 2% yield on this property. And after land taxes and other costs, it could be next to like pretty close to, you know, a 1% yield on your investment after cost, maybe even below that in some cases, while interest rates are 6.5%, which now puts it down to who can actually attract this sort of strategy. You've got to be pretty aggressive with your property investing strategy. You're not looking for a simple buy and hold sort of approach. Yeah. It's an aggressive investor strategy, and you often need to be in the $1 million plus budget range to really benefit from this, which rules out a lot of investors as well. So the risks are, you know, negative cash flow, large holding costs, the planning uncertainty, and also the due diligence. You know, you could easily buy the wrong site. There's so much due diligence on sites that are available. Maybe you won't be able to do what you want to do on this site, even after it's changed zoning for whatever reason. So there's so much uncertainty here. It makes it actually hard to plan an investing strategy around. You got to be willing to take on a lot of risk and a lot of uncertainty in the face of negative cash flow to go and actually do, which for most people will probably rule them out from actually participating here.
Yeah, I think the negative cash flow is the big one to keep in mind, because like these investments aren't fun to hold, like until they pay off, if that makes sense. And like you say, for a lot of people, that is probably a bit of a deal breaker in what they're like looking to achieve. Like you have to wade through a fair amount of pain in terms of like obviously all the due diligence, but just the straight up negative cash flow of holding a really, really low yielding underutilized piece of land until you're able to either develop it yourself or sell it off to a developer and, you know, achieve that premium.
Could be 5 years as well.
Yeah.
Could you stage this out, being like, I'm going to do this bit now, this bit later, this bit in 5 years. This is our implementation plan. You could be holding it for 5 years. That could be hundreds of thousands of dollars
exactly.
in holding costs.
Just because the changes go through overnight, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to get a developer with an offer on your door the next day. Like, it might be fast, but you have to be able to budget for the fact that you could be holding this, like you say, for several years before you're able to realize a gain. And if you're not in the, if you haven't run the numbers and gone, okay, I'm comfortable cash flow wise holding this thing for that period of time,
yep.
You might be in a position where you end up offloading it for no real capital gain before you've got the opportunity to see this, because you couldn't sustain the cash flow side of it.
True, that's true. I think this is more, not so much when we talk this out, it's probably not for the majority in terms of investing into, it's probably more for those that already own the assets. There's a lot of property investors across Sydney that own land near a railway station. A lot of people have already done that. This is a benefit that they're going to go and see. And they're probably expecting it at some point, being like, hey, look, I bought this, like, you know, 600 square meter corner lot next to a train station. At some point, it's going to change. Like, you know, they could just be a equation like that that they're going through. And that point is now, rather than someone looking to but purchase right now.
Yeah. And I would say another conversation we have with people is some people like to plan very aggressively, you know, to purchase multiple sites at a time, or have, you know, not just do this once, but if this strategy is going to be profitable, roll it out, you know, to the maximum extent they can. And that's, you know, particularly with, you know, a high negative cash flow, something you have to be very, very careful of if you're going to hold, you know, look to hold multiple of these sites at the same time, with a lot of uncertainty, with all of them having negative cash flow. It's not something to be taken lightly.
Yeah, definitely. What I'd sum it up as high risk, very high risk investing, because of the current sort of macro setting there, really poor cash flow, that makes it very high risk at the moment to go pursue investing in this strategy alone. And the specifics of which type of zoning change you're targeting makes it increasingly risky. If you're targeting that mid-rise stuff, that adds way more risk. There is no existing mid-rise housing code in New South Wales. They're coming from a blank page there. The R2 terrace sort of stuff, I think that's probably the most attractive bit to invest in, because that is changing the existing low-rise housing code and changing one letter from it, from R3 to R2 or some version of that, a subtle change to existing legislation. And you can dig into the existing legislation and be like, this is what you can do already. Now they're just applying it to more land profiles than currently on offer. So you can kind of work out exactly what they're offering you and what you can do with your land. So that is probably the lower risk approach. And it's also typically, you know, just buying land holdings near a railway station. Yeah, that's probably not the worst investment to have in general, especially if you can find a way to get yield on that investment in the interim, you know, perhaps something with a granny flat or something like that that makes the holding cost or the yield closer to 3-4%. That makes it a bit easier to hold.
Yeah. So if we haven't scared you off with the negatives, let's talk through some of the positives or some of the upside that you can get out of this strategy. So like you mentioned, one of the biggest opportunities to see an alpha increase in Sydney we've seen or can, you know, the in our time. Do you want to unpack that a little bit more?
Yeah. So the benefit's huge. If you own a piece of land, for example, and it's in a premium area and now you can put apartments on it while you could only put one house on it before, the value of that land is about to shoot up because of these changes. That is pretty much going to happen if you meet the criteria of my land can now do this change. And if you want to simplify it, if you look around on the AFR Rich List and you check it out, there's a lot of property developers there. And a lot of those property developers have simply bought pieces of land like this, you know, over time. A lot of their stories began like this. You look at Pagewood, you know, Harry's been purchasing there for a long, long period of time. Little Bay, for example, Miranda, and the shopping center in and around there, there's been huge developers that have purchased their land holdings in key locations that simply zoned up over a period of time. Big opportunity. Big pockets offer greater opportunity. So maybe it'll be like a more of an insto thing, like something that institutions look at, super funds and things like that, people with deep pockets, large capital holdings. You know, that is probably the players who are going to be participating in this. Mum and dad investors, you know, those running businesses earning really, really good incomes with large capital positions, they could look into, you know, potentially acquiring one or two of these sort of products that could benefit. But that's really the sort of profile in this high interest rate environment. It's not affordable investing that we're talking about. It's really unaffordable investing that I'm talking about. But land is what wins. And it also showcases what may not win actually as well. Because if you think of Sydney as a whole, if they're adding more housing supply and the zoning changes are big, that means more housing is on the way. It might not be now, might not be in 2 years, might be in 5 years' time, 10 years' time. It means more apartments are on the way near railway stations and things like that. So, you know, probably gives you a little bit of a signal for where supply is coming online that may not be there at the moment. That generally supply is what suppresses price growth. And you could see supply coming in certain types of product, apartments, townhouses and things like that. Near railway stations, you're going to see more supply of that in time.
Yeah, I think in terms of, you know, benefiting, I think the other key point is you've spoken about how difficult it is to get planning changes through and how much pushback there is. So, you know, reading through this and having this discussion, just given the scope of the changes, this feels like if it does go through kind of relatively close to as proposed, you know, this is essentially, you know, once in a decade kind of changes. It's not
bigger.
Yeah, once in a generation possibly.
Yep.
So it's not something that, you know, you're going to go, okay, well, they're going to make some planning changes this year and, you know, there'll be another opportunity like this that pops up in 2 or 3 years' time. These things happen.
Not this mass. There will definitely be opportunities. They'll change earnings, but not on mass.
Something like this.
Across the board, everything.
There'll be tweaks, but this is like I say, potentially a once in a generation sized change. So it's an opportunity that's not going to roll around every couple of years that you're going to see.
No. The reason for that is because effectively what this is doing is taking the power away from councils who now control planning rules of their locations. What the state is doing is saying, you know what? This has produced pretty crappy outcomes for Australians, for Sydneysiders. Like, planning is failing here. The current setup is you set your planning rules, you set your LEPs, you set your DAs. All this stuff is taking too long. It's just not delivering on action. The state is coming in and saying, I'm taking it away. I'm taking it all away. You can go do your high-rise stuff, but I'm taking it away. You have to do what we say. It's a non-refusal standard into the legislation that they're proposing and saying, you must accept DA applications that meet these criteria. And even then, we can even draw it up for all of these developers in these pattern book designs that they talk about and say, if you put in this design that we have created, put it on your land, that local council has to say yes. They can't refuse it. So they are taking power away from councils and giving it to a state or developers, really, by providing them certainty, do this and we'll get it approved and we'll get it approved quicker. That's what they're saying. That sort of change just doesn't happen very often at all. Like, I don't know Sydney's planning history well enough to talk about previous times, but that's not a once in generation. That's not a once in decade change. You know, where I live and most places that I look at have barely changed in the last decade or two. Very, very subtle changes. This is much, much bigger than that.
Yeah, exactly. So that's a little bit unpacking the pros and cons. Yep. Give people a little bit of a flavor. If they are looking at this strategy or interested in it, what sort of site should they be looking at? What do they need to be targeting? We've spoken a little bit like land is key. But yeah, do you want to unpack that a little bit further to finish off this pod without maybe giving away too much of your own IP? But
That's fine. So what type of land should benefit from this? Look, it's so much land. Like, if you want to really simplify it, near a railway station, you're probably looking in the right spot, very close to a railway station, within walking to a railway station, nice frontages, decent land sizes, 500 square meter plus, probably going to be doing well when you meet those general criteria. But really, you've got to be running a feasibility and doing thorough DD on what it's like as a developer. Now, that can't be unpacked in one podcast. That is extremely detailed. There's so many frameworks that go in at each site that we look at. For example, there's a really detailed checklist that goes through it. There's often consultant calls, there's often engineering calls, there's often stormwater issues to address, easements, title issues, checking out section 149 certificates, seeing what is possible. Recently I found one with a groundwater exclusion zone that made things a little bit more difficult. But there's so many due diligence criteria that need to be taken into account that, you know, expertise probably helps a little bit here, or an experience probably helps a little bit here. You often learn by mistakes and learning through doing, that will help. But broad strokes is buy near a railway station, good plot of land, with nice frontage, you're looking in the right spot just by that sort of framework. Yeah, that would be my high-level summary of what to look for.
Which, funnily enough, is essentially, you know, going back to the fundamentals, if you're looking at land, they are some of the basic fundamentals to get capital growth out of land, you know, buying your key infrastructure assets.
Yep.
If you can have a decent frontage and a decent plot size.
You know, being very open about it, none of this is going to pop up in any data sense, like, because you're going to look at data in this suburb and be like, house prices may have rose, but there's going to be lots of houses that sell, and it's median house price data that's reported, and be like, hey, look, median house prices in areas outside that station zone may not have got up. So you're not going to find much of this in data metrics. If you stick to really macro figures, you're not going to see this. So that's like a buzzword for people nowadays to look at when they're investing. And yes, it really helps to work out trends in what's going to do well in the really short run. But this is something completely separate. It's alpha investing, really. It's about land. It's about fundamentals of property investing. And those that focus on those fundamentals are going to be rewarded in Sydney because these changes are pretty massive. Whether they go through or not, I don't know. Like, that bit's completely uncertain. There's so much groundwork to go through. The state government, are you saying that mid-2024 is when they plan on doing all this? Seems like a lot to do by mid-2024. And that transport-oriented development stuff, I think it's end of April, which is, you know, a couple months away. Pretty big zoning changes there in that short time period. I don't know whether they're going to be able to implement all of that. If you circle it back, we did a YouTube video on this as to why are they so keen to get this done really, really quickly. On 1 July this year, we start a reporting window and we're counting the number of dwellings we are building. And if we hit certain targets and beat those targets, we get paid an extra. The state government is getting paid an extra $15,000 directly from the federal government for each dwelling they build that's above a certain target. Money is being thrown at the state and the state is responding. The state is like, go build, please. We want this money. So money talks. The federal government, if this is good policy, if you view this as good policy and it's achieving outcomes to help solve the housing crisis, the federal government have pulled the levers to make all of this happen. The state government are the bad guys that are going and doing it and taking power away from local councils. And it's like a shakeup in power, I guess. And it's being driven by money.
Yeah, which makes sense. So, you know, the federal government probably have the most power, potentially not in planning laws, but basically, like you say, they're the ones that will offer the carrot of the cash to governments, not to the councils, and the state governments can work it out. And depending on how interested they are, they can,
it's nationwide, though.
Whatever skulls they need to, so to speak, or push heads together and upset whatever people they're going to upset if they want to do it.
Yep.
And if the incentive is large enough, you know, we'll see if it goes through.
This could be everywhere as well. Like that federal impetus that's creating the federal momentum, that is nationwide momentum that's there. And each state has the same cookie available to them, $15,000 per extra dwelling above your target level. So I'm talking about Sydney as a great opportunity. That's because I can understand these planning laws. I understand it's where I live. I walked around my street and be like, this one benefits, this one benefits. I can kind of do that really, really simple analysis. I don't know what Queensland is doing, what Victoria is doing, but I imagine they're going to follow with planning changes that actually deliver results. Try and get a little bit of the $3 billion on offer that the federal government is dishing out to the states for delivering their target.
Yeah, so the incentives are there to get some change happening. So it's going to be interesting to see how it all plays out, particularly in New South Wales over the next few months.
Yep.
But yeah, in other states as well. So yeah, it's been really useful unpacking it. I hope everyone's enjoyed listening, and we'll speak to you soon on the next episode.
Thanks, Kurt.